We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
A Potter Studies podcast. On this episode, Playing Potter. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with MuggleNet's Laurie Beckoff and Dr. Tyson Pugh about gaming Harry Potter in medieval literature and in the classroom. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds Too.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of religion and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College, and author of several Harry Potter essays.
This is another episode in our series devoted to conversations about chapters in our Potterversity companion book of essays. Today, we're taking a closer look at games in the series. So, Emily, how competitive are you? You like a good game?
It's funny that you ask that because I don't.
I really
am not a gamey sort of person. I don't really find meaning in that kind of competition. And it's really funny because I remember we got together recently at last year's Chestnut Hill conference, and we were hanging out in the evening, and our friend Laurie Beckoff suggested that we play Harry Potter Uno, and I was like,
"Oh yes,
seriously. Seriously, you're going to make me play a game. I'm away from my 10-year-old for the weekend and you're making me play a game. Seriously, you know." So I'm oddly, I don't know what it is, but I just don't get that. What about you? Are you a little more competitive than me?
I'm very competitive. I went through a phase when I was a kid where I wouldn't play winning games, is what I called them, because not only did I not like losing, but I didn't like being a winner and other people losing. It felt very icky to me. And I didn't like that. You know, you have to feel, are you supposed to brag, but then do you feel guilty and the other person's upset? And I just didn't like any of that. But, but I am also extremely competitive and there are people who will not play like trivia games with me.
I would play with you if I was on your team.
Yeah. And my husband and I do not play Scrabble anymore. It's for the good of the family.
Yeah.
So we stay together.
I get that.
Yeah. So, but I like a good game. And when I can relax a little bit more with it and have more fun with it, I do enjoy it. But I'm pretty competitive. So when I think about, you know, the games in Harry Potter, I got very worried anytime there was anything like a Quidditch match or anything. Mm. And then also, you know, I think about if you're in class and there's something where you're competing with other people in the class. Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah, I feel it.
That's probably where I'm most engaged with games, is if there's like some sort of academic content to it. Like, I do like to play Harry Potter trivia and Star Wars trivia, like with a team though. I enjoy being with a team so that you don't have what you're talking about, that awkward, you win and how are you supposed to act? You know, are you supposed to show off? You know, but if you're with a team, you get to celebrate a little bit and not feel bad about it.
Yeah, that's right. And the losers can also console each other.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. This is a great lead-in to our discussion today about playing Potter. We're going to talk games in Harry Potter, and we're going to discuss Laurie's chapter in the Potterversity book. And her chapter is called "It's All Fun and Games Until Leisurely and Competitive Pursuits in Harry Potter and Chivalric Romance." And we're also going to talk about Tyson's chapter, which is called Gamifying the Harry Potter Studies Classroom. And as I said, these are both in the Potterversity book, and we're just going to give you like a little hint of what you might expect there. So let me introduce our two guests for this episode. Lori Beckoff is the producer of our Potterversity podcast and campaign coordinator at MuggleNet. She designed the Muggle Studies department at MuggleNet that contains an amazing bibliography of Harry Potter resources. And listeners, you should definitely check that out.
Oh, yeah.
On the MuggleNet site. Oh, what a great resource. Tyson Pugh is Pegasus Professor of English at the University of Central Florida. He has written several books, including Queering Medieval Genres, On the Queerness of Early English Drama, Sex in the Subjunctive, and Harry Potter and Beyond on J.K. Rowling's Fantasies and Other Fictions. Delighted to welcome both of you, Lori and Tyson, back to the show.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, this is great because Lori and Tyson, you are both interested not only in games, but you have this other kind of in the Venn diagram of Tyson and Lori, you have this other overlap. You're both interested in the Middle Ages and Harry Potter. So what do you think is the common point of interest in these two types of literature? Lori, what do you think?
I feel like you should start with Tyson over me because he's been in this field for so long that his work has influenced a lot of mine. But if I have to go first, then I would say for me, the common points I see, number one is magic. I got interested in medieval literature because I was interested in the magic that was in that in Arthurian romance, in enchantresses and sorcerers and Merlin and magical objects. So that's number one for me. Second, I would say is heroic quests. Again, something that drew me particularly to chivalric literature and Arthurian literature. Because we see so much of that hero's journey and the quest for something greater, a battle against evil, quest for self-discovery, all of those things in both. And then I guess you could say more surface level, but kind of obvious one is the setting of Harry Potter, which although it is contemporary society, the Wizarding World has all these pre-modern relics and is sort of rooted, as has been said by scholars before, rooted in the Middle Ages. So there's always that echo in the setting itself of this old castle that was founded 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, Tyson, some of that kind of resonate with you?
Oh, definitely. I agree 100% with what Lori said. And I would just say, especially, you know, the idea of the quest. And so medieval romances, the stories of Lancelot and Galahad and the Arthurian knights, they're such a major part of our culture today, you know, whether for better or for worse. We still have these ideas of chivalry and courtly love, and they influence our perceptions of, you know, real human romances to this day. And I remember Rowling once described Harry as having a sort of Galahad quality about him. And she said, because the person who is leading the quest tends to, these are her words, have this weird purity about them. And I thought that was a really nice way of linking medieval literature with the Harry Potter stories. Because what is it that makes Harry our hero? Well, he's in the position of the hero, right? And so he's going to inhabit that, that role. And then with that role comes the quest. And obviously, the major focus of the stories is the defeat of Voldemort, which it can be seen in a quest in itself. But I like to think of it as well with, say, Harry's quest for the Horcruxes. And, you know, many readers have suggested that Harry maybe spends a little bit too much time tramping through the forest looking for the Horcruxes. But that's actually, I think, a very good part of the story because, you know, the Arthurian knights questing for the Holy Grail, if they knew where it was, they wouldn't really need to quest for it, would they, right? They would just go get it.
Right. And so
I think that's a very good, great part of the storyline to show that its investment in these medieval tropes. So the Middle Ages, the influence of medieval literature on Harry Potter is, I think, both structural to the narrative structure of the story, but also a lot of the trappings of these stories as well. Again, as Lori pointed out, magic, for instance, we would not have both the allure of both of these worlds is so heavily dependent upon a fantasy world that is rooted in our real world, but so wonderfully different at the same time.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking as you were talking too, you know, Harry is a Galahad figure, but Ron also, I think, has knightly qualities. And I know, Laurie, that Ron has a special place in your heart.
I was about to cut you off, Katie. Yes, I do think that Ron has a lot of knightly qualities, specifically compared to Gawain. But you can read more about that in an article I wrote for MuggleNet.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
All right.
Unless you want me to go off about it.
you don't have to. No.
No.
I mean, that's a good reference. Tease. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, you've written quite a lot of good stuff about this. So again, I'm just delighted to be able to have the two of you on. It struck me as a kind of interesting and unusual overlap, but it makes total sense. Fits. You know, the medieval mm-hmm. qualities of Harry Potter really, really do come through.
Laurie and Tyson. Some people would argue, not me, but some people would argue that games are really just kind of in the text for comedic effect, or they're there to sort of distract the reader momentarily from more serious themes of the work. But you two both argue differently. So why should we take a serious look at games in literature?
Well, one of the ways I would answer this is, again, focusing on structure. And, you know, there's a literary theory concept called ludonarratology. So ludo is the game, narratology is narrative structure. And, you know, this takes as its interest the ways in which games can shape narrative structures. And so Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is a great example of this. It's a collection of stories, but it's also a tale-telling competition. And so there's a ludic element, a game element to the story. Another great example from medieval literature, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which focuses on a beheading game. The Green Knight comes into according to Arthur's court and has a very interesting proposal of a pastime in which they exchange blows. And we can see this in a range of fiction, not just medieval literature. You know, we can see it in films. There was a movie in the 1990s by David Fincher, The Game. And so that's another good example. But also, David Fincher likes a lot of serial killer movies like Seven and Zodiac, the one about the Zodiac killer in the San Francisco area. Mm. And those movies really engage with games, too, the games that you're caught in when other people are playing them. So I think a lot of stories can be productively conceived as playing with their readers and audiences. And, you know, perhaps even more obviously is video games. Video games don't need, not all video games have a story, but a lot of the better video games do, merge the gaming element with the narrative element. So I think games and literature are mutually constitutive in many ways, and it's helpful to consider the ways in which they successfully or in other ways unsuccessfully combine. I mean, obviously for Harry Potter, the biggest game in the series is Quidditch, which is not just, you know, a diversion from the text, but really helps to build the themes. Mm-hmm. And right, the House Cup tournament every year, and of course the Triwizard tournament too. So these games are not just random events that happen in the story, but ways that Rowling is using gaming to develop her characters, to develop plot points, to develop other themes. And so to just, say that the games of the Harry Potter novels are just, you know, kind of a side part of the story. Well, sure, it's not the focus of defeating Voldemort, but yet then again, there's Voldemort at the end of the Triwizard Tournament. So it's a little bit more important mm-hmm. than maybe we thought at first.
I agree with everything Tyson said. I think that games often do a lot of heavy lifting, and that when I always think about how much they're cut out of the Harry Potter films and how we miss out on some really essential moments of characterization. And I think even when they're used for comic effect, that comic effect is sometimes telling us something about what people in this society find funny or find entertaining or find absurd. And you know, people have pointed out how ridiculous Quidditch is. And I think that's reflective of a lot of things in the Wizarding World that are really, really ridiculous. So I think that paying attention to, especially in fantasy literature, the types of games that people are playing and how they're playing them and how spectators react to them and how players react to them tells us a lot about what kind of world we're dealing with. I think particularly with Quidditch, I've seen comparisons to it talking about it being very British boarding school rugby and, you know, ways in which it's negative in that way, but establishing a certain type of atmosphere. But then on the other hand, being utterly ridiculous. So is it making fun of that? So I think that there's so much both direct heavy lifting in terms of leading toward the plot, tying it with major characterization, as well as metaphorical significance of what is this telling us about these people and the society in which they reside.
Your idea about sort of how it's linked to British boarding school tradition, you know, that people have talked about, I think, you know, that comes through in terms of the idea of what is the society preparing people to be able to do through their games? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think about Emily, your title for the Quidditch essay in the Harry Potter for Nerds book, which was
the second war was won on the Quidditch pitch of Hogwarts.
Yes, right. So making that like direct connection to cricket, I think, right? That's cricket quote.
Or rugby.
Yeah.
Something they played at one of the boarding schools.
I'm not very sporty. Eton. Sorry.
Eton. I think it was.
Yes, yeah. Eton. Yeah. And so the idea that was supposed to train young boys in a particular kind of, you know, teamwork and competition and
conflict.
Yeah. And empire building and all those kinds of ideas. And to sort of then say, okay, well then, like Laura, you were saying, what's Quidditch doing in that regard? A lot of heavy lifting, as you say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Laura, your chapter focuses on the connection between games and Arthurian literature, particularly Gawain and the Green Knight, which Tyson already mentioned a little bit. And then the games like Quidditch, but also some other games in Harry Potter. What do you think are the similarities, differences, and, you know, what are the roles that they're performing in their stories?
I think the big thing that I see shared between the two of them is development of different types of skills, social skills, psychological skills, emotional, intellectual, physical skills, most directly. And I think this is both how people are, the players show themselves to the rest of the world, the people they are playing for or against, as well as to the readers. I think there are also ways in which characters encounter real danger, whether or not they're actually on a battlefield, both for knights and for wizards. Some of these games get really dangerous. Almost every game for knights is pretty dangerous, their tournaments. And Quidditch is a really, really dangerous sport as well.
Yeah.
Triwizard Tournament, which I think is the most like a medieval tournament. It's literally a medieval tournament. It's centuries old, is incredibly dangerous.
People can die.
People do die.
Yeah.
They do.
Sorry,
die.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
People die. Oh, no. And I think in that, in showing that what skills are being developed and how dangerous these games are or are not, that's telling us something additionally about what values there are in the society. You know, when it's okay to have people play a game that's really dangerous, does that mean that the society doesn't care about them or that there's value in putting your life on the line, which certainly for knights there is. And it seems that for wizards, at least in the Triwizard Tournament, there's something that's very much respected about being willing to go up in a tournament where you might die. So I definitely think that there's a lot of similarity in the way the players and spectators approach it and societies approach games in these, and what we learn about the characters as readers through watching how they play games. When we're seeing, you know, who's brave and noble and righteous and who's, you know, a cheater, who would play dirty, who does not have the qualities that make a great wizard or a great knight.
Draco.
Oh, yes.
If I could just say.
Right. Draco. Who buys their way into the team.
Exactly. And those characters who have a chance to grow through playing those games. There are a number of knights who, you know, in Mallory and Lamorte d'Arthur, these knights are winning worship by doing well in knightly games. Lancelot is praised as being so great because he does so well in tournaments, not just because of any actual battles. So these games often play out war because that's what knights are supposed to be good at. But at the same time, there's chess in both Arthurian literature and Harry Potter. And that's a much more intellectual game where we see some more development of Ron. I'm gonna go on my Ron. I'm up on my Ron soapbox now.
Yes.
That Ron's
we
heroism,
knew what would happen.
Ron's both strategy and heroism come out in this chess match. And there are a whole bunch of Arthurian examples of chess. featuring both Gawain, Percival, and Lancelot, in which chess is this opportunity, specifically magical chess as well, is this opportunity to learn something and develop as a man, as a thinker, as a knight in ways that aren't just about fighting. So chess in particular, I think, serves a really important role in both. For all those similarities, the main difference that I see is the fact that knights are adults and essentially professionals. Participating in tournaments is basically a requirement of knighthood. Whereas we have these kids at Hogwarts, you know, 11 and 12 years old sometimes, or for Harry, 14, but going into this potentially fatal tournament. So that's where I think we see a really major difference of, you know, knights undertake this knowing exactly what the risks are, and they are adults who are capable of making their own decisions. And it's basically a job for them a lot of the time. Even if not specifically tournaments, the way that Gawain approaches the Green Knight, it's, well, this is part of being a knight, is taking on quests like this, is taking on what might be a game, but is going to be important. That's being a knight. Being a wizard, especially a 14-year-old wizard, should not necessarily involve Magic Death Tournament.
That's my favorite title for the Triwizard Tournament. Magic Death Tournament.
Is that from Puffs?
I don't think so. It should but be. Now that I said it's it out wonderful. Loud, can't be sure.
Lori, what does seeing these links gain us in terms of our understanding of this literature?
I think it makes us think about what's plot and what's diversion, going back to your earlier question, when we should be actively paying attention, not just let me skip over this part where they have a lot of tilts with the jousts and basically a bunch of people get unhorsed, or, okay, yeah, there's another Quidditch match now, I don't really care. And I think mainly that the role it's performing is we're seeing character building and world building. So we're getting an establishment of heroic identity, and we're getting the revealing of the values and the pitfalls of a society. And a lot is being told through how these games are played, how people react to them, how they participate in them, and how they're organized and why they're organized. So those for me are the two big ones, that character building and that world building, and really creating a sense of what is considered heroic in such a society and who we should see as heroic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you nailed me on the skipping over the jousting stuff in the Arthurian literature. Oh, man.
I have admittedly, writing this paper, I had a bit of a problem that I realized, wow, I can explain off the top of my head, you know, the major plot arcs pretty easily in Lamort d'Arthur. And I have definitely skimmed. I'm very guilty of having skimmed the jousts. So I had to go back and read them in depth this time and think, okay, I might actually learn something about some people here. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I did.
Yeah. Look at that. Very cool. See, I always loved the Quidditch in Harry Potter. That was always just a good action scene for me. That was just, you know, and they're often very funny as well. You know, there's a lot of humor in there because there's a lot of mishap and potential for mishap. So.
And Dementors.
And yeah.
Broken just, bones.
Right, right.
Potential
vanished
death.
Bones, eventually. Yeah, yeah, right, exactly.
And I think it's where we see a number of characters come into their own, not just Harry, but Ron and Ginny, especially. I think that's where you really start to see a lot of Ginny, is when she starts playing Quidditch.
Right, right, yeah.
As well as true. Oliver Wood, whose entire personality is Quidditch, but it's a pretty entertaining personality.
Right. And the twins were always, you know, there to be, you know, at their entertaining best, you know, during Quidditch. So,
but also, like, if you think about all the stuff going on in the stands, you know, and how Hermione's activity, right, as especially with Ron trying out, and then the costumes that they're wearing. And yeah, there's good stuff happening in the stands among the audience, too.
I think subtext. Aside from Quidditch, I think the Triwizard Tournament, and for me, what's happening behind the scenes at the Triwizard Tournament is one of the most significant occurrences in the series. And I think that's really our introduction to the way this government is going to work going forward. So it's all those kind of little hints, again, that mostly got cut out from the movie of Goblet of Fire, where we're hearing about Ludo Bagman, we're hearing about the mismanagement of things, about the cheating, and all these little, and about Barty Crouch not showing up, and all these little things that add up for These people have no idea what they're doing for what is supposedly a game. Mm-hmm. This is going to get even worse from here on out.
Right. Yeah. You can see the mismanagement, you know, and what it, you know, what it forebodes. Tyson, you've done a cool thing pedagogically. We've spoken to you on the podcast before about the kind of games that you have incorporated into your classroom. How have you incorporated games into your Harry Potter classes, and how have students responded to them?
Yeah, well, in building my Harry Potter class, I was, you know, inspired by Hogwarts's Four Houses and the House Cup tournament, and ways in which I could, you know, kind of recreate them for the classroom, use them as educational structures. So I thought, why not put the class in four teams and let them compete for the glories of the Harry Potter Studies House Cup? So for most of our class sessions, the students engage in, you know, some sort of low stakes brainstorming exercise. And generally the one that comes up with the most examples will win that. And so they'll get, you know, 10 house points for the day or something to that effect. And over the course, you know, every class of the semester, I update the scoreboard so they can see how they're doing. And by the end of the semester, the winning team wins very little of importance, right? A couple of bonus points. I print out a certificate that I ask them to keep on their refrigerator for at least a week, you know. Maybe if I can scrounge up some money for an ice cream social. It's a very low stakes game, but I think it, you know, does bring a small level of competition, right? I hope healthy competition to the classroom. And there's certainly anecdotal evidence that the students enjoy it. One of the things that I simply like about it, and that is why I'll keep on doing it, is just that I think a lot of us who have taught for a couple of decades now, believe it or not, I have. If we think back to when we started and we walked into a classroom, it was pretty common for the students to be talking to each other. And about, you know, 5-7 years ago, I noticed a lot less students talking to each other before class.
Oh, yeah.
Because if they didn't mm-hmm. know each other, they would just look at their phones.
Right.
You know, at the very least, the team members know each other. They have to know each other because they're on a team. And so I think the camaraderie of the Harry Potter class mm-hmm. is worth keeping this game for that alone.
Yeah. You know, you think about it, like yeah. That's probably partly why they have the houses at Hogwarts also, yeah. right? That it gives you a family within the school. And
oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Reduces the size of the world.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, it's nice to have their little corner of the class. You know, all the houses are expected to sit together. And they know every class, they'll at least have this, you know, one brainstorming or mini discussion that they'll do with each other. And so, you know, and of course, right, not every classroom activity goes for the full amount of time allotted. And so, yeah, there's a couple of minutes here and there where they just chat with each other and you can see some real friendships forming in the class. And
that's
so,
great. And I think Emily yeah. and I already said we would be into this kind of competition.
Yeah,
like a little teams. Academic teams. Team-based. Yeah. Oh yeah. yeah.
Sign us up.
I'd be trying for that certificate for my fridge.
I really do stress over the semester. This is low stakes, people.
You know, yeah.
I don't want people to get stressed out over it or have it to be one more thing to worry about. It's, you know, it's just a little thing. It should be fun. So please treat it as fun and enjoy the experience, but don't worry so much about winning and losing, because that's, you know, winning and losing can be the bad part of games where you have mm-hmm. to have someone lose. And, you know, 75% of the class at the end of the semester will lose. And so I don't want them to feel that it was a bad experience or anything like that because of, you know, this running theme throughout the course.
Tyson, I have to ask, sure. because I was thinking about this while reading your chapter, have you had people get upset about it? Because I'm thinking about the fact that I would not want to do this because I'm a Gryffindor and I take competition very, very seriously when it's something that I deeply care about. Like, I can tolerate losing just, you know, a regular game of something I'm not particularly invested in. But when it comes to competition about something like Harry Potter, I think I'd be a monster. I think about how I was happy I didn't have the chance to take a Harry Potter class in college, because I think it would have destroyed me a little bit. Like, I got to do my own independent research, but I don't think I could be trusted to keep it together when it's competition of, you know, who can analyze Harry Potter the best, because when I've invested most of my life into doing that, it's like, I don't think everyone else will understand. So I'm just curious if you have people who are a little too into it, or do get caught up in the competition.
Not that it's been brought directly to my attention. I think that's something that the houses have dealt with, right, on their own, where one of the things that I have as well is every house has a rector. And, you know, so someone like my contact person for the group. And so they're given a little bit of authority, and they can help respond to anything. I would hate for a student to not be able to enjoy the class because of this one aspect of it. And so I think it's, you know, important to keep it very, very low stakes. And so that's what I try to do with it. But yes, some people take competition very seriously, and that can be very, you know, that can be wonderful. But for the class as a whole, I try to keep it as a, you know, just a manageable dynamic.
So besides getting the students to kind of interact with each other more and sort of reducing the size of the classroom to their house and their team, what do you see as the value of games, particularly Harry Potter style games, for student learning?
Just, it's not a huge part of the class. And so, it's really brainstorming exercises, just, you know, getting your initial thoughts down that are then kind of repackaged as a game. And so, I mean, just to take one example, you know, when we discuss fairy tales, I asked them to just brainstorm as many connections between fairy tales you've read and the Harry Potter novels. And so Hermione as Cinderella at the ball, or Hagrid as a fairy godmother or god person, right? These are all examples that come up. And so it's a really good exercise, brainstorming exercise, where they're just putting things down. And so the game structure is actually secondary to it. Right. It's just, it's more to get a discussion going.
Right. It's like a motivator.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
While reading your chapter, I was trying to do all of them and see how many I could come up with alone. I had to compete against your students while reading the chapter.
Wow. I will send you a certificate, Lori.
Yeah. How many points for Gryffindor? How many do I get?
Well, just one certificate, a set of Mardi Gras beads. I can give you 10 bonus points, but you're not in my class, so they don't do anything for you.
They mean nothing. Lori, I highly recommend the online Harry Potter graduate course at Signum University. You're just a student. You don't compete with the other students. They evaluate your work independently. So, maybe that's for you.
Maybe. I need to appeal more to my Ravenclaw side. But when it's competitive, there goes my Gryffindor, which is what I really am, takes over.
Tyson also in his chapter talks about an award based on Neville Longbottom. And I'm just going to tease that. So you have to read it in the chapter. But he is doing a lot of kind of fun things to have different ways of you know, earning points, of winning the game and so on. So one of the interesting points that comes up in both of your chapters is the nature of performance associated with gaming. How does performing in a competitive context impact the competitor and the larger community? Lori, what do you think?
For me, it's two main points for competitors: pride and pressure. I think that if you have a chance to do really well, that can help boost self-esteem. And if you perform badly, that can destroy self-esteem. And I think Ron is the primary example of that. He can get a little bit cocky and self-confident, but also to the point of cockiness when he does really well in Quidditch. But mostly he feels sick at the idea of being on show and possibly messing up. When he's, you know, just playing around or in practice, he's usually okay until he starts thinking about having to go in front of a crowd. So for him, it's a nightmare until he does well and he's got support, and then it helps his self-confidence. In terms of the community, I think the same thing kind of spreads out toward the community in terms of someone's reputation. You know, Harry is such a school hero when he does well in a Quidditch match, like almost more so than when he, you know, defeats Voldemort. You know, who cares about that? It's mostly he wants the Quidditch Cup. And for Ron, you know, the Slytherins are being horrible to him in the hallways every time he, you know, has an upcoming Quidditch match or does poorly in a Quidditch match. And the way that someone is viewed by the school is based on, you know, knowing how they did in the Quidditch match, mm-hmm. whether they're heroes or, you know, pariahs. And I think that applies to knights too. Someone like Lancelot going to be very well respected, but sometimes some of these knights even choose to, you know, cover their faces, not want to be favored, and, you know, be sure that no one's giving them an easy time of it. And so that they choose anonymity to really get to prove themselves truly. So I think that's where performance ties in the most for me.
What about you, Tyson, in terms of this idea of, you know, performing academically through gaming?
Well, just, and this is again, just more of an anecdotal observation. I'm not sure it has any basis on fact, but it seems to me doing these the House Cup challenges in my Harry Potter class that the students tend to assume the personalities of their houses. And maybe I'm just projecting, but mm-hmm. is it true that the Slytherins become a little bit slyer, a little bit more ambitious? They're Ravenclaws seem to take themselves, you know, very seriously in their academic endeavors. The Hufflepuffs usually do extremely well. Like most Hufflepuff teams are in it, right? Because they're just being great Hufflepuffs, just being great, you know, just doing their job. And Gryffindors, sometimes I think they assume they're going to win because they're associated with Harry.
Yep.
So I think it's interesting the different ways that people, I mean, a game is both ourself and a separate space of ourselves where, right, maybe the normal rules of our personality do or don't apply. And I think that could come out with how, you know, we can play a role when we're playing a game sometimes.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about, we were talking about how games also relate to kind of larger social structures. Do either of you see these games revealing or subverting even existing power structures or hierarchies?
I hope not, because I'm the professor of the class.
Yeah, I guess I wonder, do you see like some kids who end up doing really well because they're good at coming up with, you know, examples, and so they can become heroic even though they might have been, you know, seen as, you know, nerdy or something?
I have the outside view of the groups. So I don't have insider perspective on what's going on in each of the little sessions. That's a great question, but I really don't see it as the teacher. You know, I go by and make sure they're doing okay, but usually they tell me they're doing fine and mm-hmm. you know, yeah. encourage me to just keep on walking.
Move on.
What do you think, Lori?
For subverting power structures, I think that happens when someone sort of has a chance to prove themselves despite their background. So Harry, for example, comes into the wizarding world knowing nothing about this Quidditch game everyone's talking about. He feels like an outsider. And when he realizes he's good at it, suddenly, you know, he already has a special place in the wizarding world as the chosen one, but he's now afforded this place that's based on his own accomplishments, his own talents. And he's no longer this, you know, kid who doesn't get anything about this world. In terms of revealing existing power structures, I think what we mentioned before about the economic disparities, about who can afford which brooms, and that makes a really big difference in Quidditch. That's where, yeah, Ron and the other Weasleys can't afford great brooms, and Malfoy has the ability to buy brooms for his entire team. So that comes out on the playing field. I think with knights too, you know, knights are nobility. You're not getting the average Joe just coming and, you know, like in A Knight's Tale or something. That's not really happening. The knights are showing off their, you know, noble blood, their aristocratic metal.
Yeah. And I was thinking about too, you know, you were talking about a lot of the behind the scenes stuff at the Triwizard Tournament that is showing what's, you know, the sort of fault lines in the wizard government and so on. And, you know, the way that the different teams are, you know, they're cheating creatively and who's, you know, who's helping whom. And I was thinking about Ludo Bagman, who's obviously put a lot of money on Harry, just trying to make sure Harry wins, you know, and that you could sort of see some of those exchanges happening through the Triwizard Tournament too. Thanks for joining us on the show today. What we have discussed, I'll just remind you listeners, it's the tip of the iceberg. So you'll want to read their full chapters. And so pick up our Potterversity book and then let us know what you think. We're going to end this episode with a quote from the gamiest of all the Harry Potter novels, The Goblet of Fire, where during the Triwizard Tournament, there's some debate about how to award points after the second task. Harry Potter used gillyweed to great effect, Bagman continued. He returned last and well outside the time limit of an hour. However, the Mayor Chieftainess informs us that Mr. Potter was first to reach the hostages and that the delay in his return was due to his determination to return all hostages to safety, not merely his own. Ron and Hermione both gave Harry half exasperated, half commiserating looks. Most of the judges, and here Bagman gave Karkaroff a very nasty look. Most of the judges feel that this shows moral fiber and merits full marks. However, Mr. Potter's score is 45 points. Remember, folks, it's how you play the game.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to PotterversityPodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.